happens all the time. This crazy love of mine wraps around my heart, refusing to unwind.
Week 2. Crazy love. We're looking at rediscovering God's voice in romance and relationship. And if you're a guest today, if you're worshiping in the link, we're delighted that we can come and hear again what God has to say. And I think a culture where we're a little confused, we need a new compass. God's compass is the best compass. And so we're going to launch into this. I invite you to take out your teaching notes. If you're a guest, we always put the outline of the message in the program that allows you to follow along. In fact, the passage from Song of Solomon is there. You can follow along and read when I get to those verses in a few moments. Last week's title was Crazy for You, or Is This Crazy? And the idea here is this picture of a sequential approach to the issue of dating and romance. Today I'm going to be talking about Crazy About You, and you can see the sequence there. So I'm taking us from those first attraction places to when you're starting to date and woo and to win and to wed and then to deal with conflict that comes in relational contexts and then hopefully a faithfulness where we finish well at the end. And what are all of those different themes? And the Song of Solomon speaks to the themes, not sequentially. It's not written that way, but the themes are there, and I packaged them sequentially because I think it will help us understand this issue of relationships that are so important. Last week, we left it off with a line that was kind of a fun line, that your bed is verdant. I said that this is a married couple flashback into earlier times when they're first married, and they see their bed as verdant, which means this lush green field. I can only think that that would enhance romance if you saw your bed as a lush green field that you want to lay in and play in and all of that. Well, as is the case, some of you guys had some fun with that. One of our married guys last week got creative and sent me what he put on his door. He made a little sign to put on his bedroom door, and it goes like this. Verdant garden, enter at the risk of great pleasure. I go, how did that work for you? You know, I didn't want to know too much, but that was really pretty creative. Put it on his door. I could only imagine there were a few laughs in their home last Sunday night. Let's understand that the Hebrew culture, that they didn't date the way that we date. So we're looking at this Hebrew poem. Their relationships were arranged. Their marriages were arranged. How'd you like to have your mom or dad choose for you your mate? Most of us would get, no, thank you. We're not interested. But this still happens around the world today. In fact, we have members, Westwood couple, that have such a relationship. I want to introduce you to Satish and Shabana. And they come from India, and they've been at Westwood since 2005, and their parents arranged their marriage. There's more than one way to do this, friends, let me tell you. And I want you to hear their story. We were together a week or so ago, and we laughed. We were together for an hour or so, and we just laughed. We couldn't stop laughing. How are we going to do this in 10 minutes? And they really do a very, very nice job. How long have you been married?
It'll be 15 years in July.
Yeah, and you have a family, too.
Yes, we have a son who's 10 and a daughter who's 8.
Yep, 15 years of marriage, 2 children, arranged by your parents, and you still like each other?
Mm-hmm. You're here.
That's a good answer for this particular purpose. And it's hard for us in the West to understand how in the world parents do this. Tell us how it actually works out. What's the practice look like?
Growing up in India, we were used to the concept of an arranged marriage, and we knew from a very young age that when it was time for us, that parents would do all the hard work for us. So usually in India, a girl is considered ready for marriage when she's about 21, and for a boy, it's 27. And before they hit that age, parents get busy, and they start letting friends, extended family, and the church know that they're looking for somebody for their childhood. So as soon as that happens...
Just wait a minute there now, Shabana. So your parents just kind of put an email blast out there and say, any good ideas? Is that how it works?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
And then they, the grapevine in India is pretty speedy, so you start getting back the information so fast that, parents will then go through that list and they kind of narrow it down to what they're interested in. And then the first step is they'll, if they like a family, they'll ask for the girl or for the bridegroom's picture, and they exchange pictures, photographs, and they, you know, and if they like what they see, they move to the next step, which is they meet.
Wait a minute. So they get a picture.
Yeah.
And on the basis of that picture, if they like what they see, mm-hmm. they'll go to that next level. Wow. Go ahead. Okay. I'm tracking. This is just an amazing thing to me, how this works. Okay.
And then the next step is they meet at a common place. It'll be either at church or it'll be at a wedding. Okay. And after that, if they still, you know, if the boy and girl like each other in person, then the parents start the next level of, you know, negotiation between both families. And then they kind of have like a formal engagement after that.
And how long does all of that take?
It can be really fast. Sometimes it can happen within like a week. Sometimes it can take more than like a year. So,
yeah. Wow. Okay, Satish, how did you meet Siobhan?
Yeah, I was working here in Hutchinson, Minnesota, and I told my parents I was ready to get married. And so when I went to India, I had about 3 weeks. So my parents...
So yeah, they're working feverishly for you now.
So okay. they did all the hard work, and they got me a list of prospective brides. And I went there, and the first 10 days, met a few of them, and things didn't work out both ways. And so I'm like sitting there and saying, Mom, you know, I'm pretty much ready to go back now. I mean, there's nothing. And so...
This is like an abbreviated version of eHarmony.com, but a lot cheaper, right?
Yeah. And then my mom said, okay, there's this one girl that my sister and my parents had seen her in one of the church functions. And they said, well, there's one girl, and we think she's a real good person and a good family. And so by design, they had brought her to visit our house. And she was in a room, and me and my grandfather were in another room, and then the electricity goes off. And so then I go in and ask her, would you like to join me and my grandfather in the other room so you're not all by yourself? And she says, no. So apparently my charms didn't work, and strike one. And then my grandfather says, no, bring her. And so I go, you know, you have to pull the grandfather card. And then she comes in, and she comes and sits down, and she talks. And as we're talking... She then starts looking for a bride for me, so it's kind of strike two. And you know, then after that, I keep talking to her, and then I said, "What kind of a person would you like, and would you like to marry?" And she says, "The only thing I really want is a guy who's really tall." So strike three. So all that done, and but I said this was the person I wanted to be with. She had no clue that she was a prospective bride, so she was herself. She was just having a lot of fun, and I just loved that. So
okay, wait a minute. Now you got three strikes, and you're thinking this is the one that's for me. Well, that's a quick leap there, Satish. Yeah. I don't know how you arrived at that one so well, but okay. So now you're thinking that way. Shimana doesn't know that she's a prospect, and there's a reason why she doesn't know. Explain the sense of order that's part of the culture.
In India, usually, I have an older sister. She's about a year older than me. So in India, we usually go by order. The sister gets married first, and then, you know, the older one gets married. And then, so I wasn't even thinking that, you know, something like this would happen.
She's got to get married first before it's your turn. So it's not like she's not with it and can't figure out what's going on. There's an order to what's happening. So Satish, pick up the story from there.
Yeah, and then so the next day morning, I told my parents, I said, this is the person I'd like to marry. And so then they get on the phone, and then they haven't asked her parents yet, so they had to bring them back on another reason to come to our house to visit. And that night they told her parents, she still doesn't know. They asked permission of her parents and said, would they be interested? And they said they would be. And so we were on our way back, dropping them off to their house. And she has no clue. And she's just picking on me and making fun of me. And I just enjoyed it. But her mom is sitting there like, you cannot talk like that. You cannot say that. And she has no clue why her mom is doing that. And then they go home. And then they asked her, you know, about it. So.
Yeah, and I had about 12 hours to decide.
Wow, 12 hours. Wow, how did you go from three strikes to, okay, how did you do that?
The thing that I really liked about him was he has a very good sense of humor, and that's what I really like.
Humor is great, it really does. I mean, this is wonderful. Okay, so India is rich with traditions when it comes to weddings.
Yep.
very different than Christians. You come, missionaries went into your region 150 years ago, and so you've got several generations of people who believed in Jesus Christ. And how have you distinguished? Because there's some sharing of the culture of India as well as the culture of Christian faith.
Yep, and there'll be a picture that comes up here, and you can see that a lot, because we were converted from Hinduism about 8 generations ago, you will see a lot of the costumes are very Indian, but also you can see mingled with a lot of the Western, her wearing the veil, me wearing more Western clothes, is kind of the mingling that happens. And the festivals and the events that happen around are still based off of the Hindu traditions, but the church, the wedding is very church-based. And the other thing that we do is instead of sharing a ring or exchanging a ring, the wife, the bride gets a chain, and this is what I'm actually tying the chain for her, and it's called a thali. The Hindu version of it, they actually have a thread that they have, and then they tie the thread and they tie 3 knots. So tying the knot actually has a specific meaning in India. And
interesting.
Yeah, and then we do a golden chain that we put, and that's the chain that you'll see there. And that, the pendant is very unique to the caste from which we come, so changes with caste. And this is a pretty heavy and big chain, and most women nowadays don't keep it on, but my wife has chosen to keep it on in respect of our marriage. Yeah. So
Shabana has it on right now.
Yeah.
And if you're interested in coming and seeing it close up and personal, it's kind of a cool thing. I just have to ask this because, you know, our orientation is so different for you. We often wait for sparks to fly before we go, oh yeah, there's a potential person to be with. You don't have sparks in that. And do you ever get sparks? Were there sparks that said yes? What does love look like in an arranged marriage? Do you fall in love? And are sparks ever part of it?
For me, I moved to the States as soon as I got married. It was like 10 days and I had to leave. And I had to leave family. I had to leave everything back. And he took really good care of me. And that really helped. And he was very patient with me. And I went through all this, you know, I couldn't drive, I couldn't do anything. So I was totally dependent on him, and he really did a great job.
He was a gentleman. Yeah, very good.
For me, the spark was when I knew I wanted to marry her.
After three strikes.
And to me, it was more, now it's about the flames, to keep the fire going. And I think a lot of that is to do the logs that keep them going are the memories that we have and the journey that we have taken together all these years, us buying the furnitures, the first sets of furniture, us having kids. We have family coming and visiting us from India, and when they come for 3 months to 6 months at a time, and they stay with us, and she takes wonderful care of them, and especially my parents. She and my mom have a wonderful relationship. I appreciate that. And also me, I lost my job a few years ago. I have one now, but she was there with me. And also in our faith journey that we have taken, with which Westwood is a big part of it, those are all the things that have really kept the flame going for us.
It's that those little things of just saying, I'm here for you, I'm with you.
Sure.
And that's a picture of what we'll see today as well. But it's an extraordinary story, and it reminds me, maybe sometimes we need to adjust our expectations around how we enter into relationship. There's a lot of different ways we can grow these things, and hopefully this series will help lay those foundations as well. You've been just a delight. Thanks for hanging in there with us. Would you thank Satish and Shabana, please? I introduced these 4 compatibilities to you last week, the non-negotiable compatibilities that lead to meaningful and sustainable relationships. I say they're non-negotiable. They need to be present. They need to be part of the continuum of dialogue that you have with somebody that you're interested in or somebody that you're married to. The spiritual compatibility, which oftentimes is the most neglected until later years in marriage. And then it begins to surface, and usually with collision if it hasn't been addressed earlier. You want to be on the same page in terms of your belief systems. Character compatibility, that there is a consistency of your inner world with your outer world so that what people see on the outside is congruent with what's on the inside, and that you behave in a way when you're one-to-one with the one that you care for in the same manner that you behave when you're in a large group setting. And then communication compatibility, those two expressions of being able to put words to your feelings, so critical to longevity in relationship. But then as well to listen empathetically to the end that you understand the need of the one that you're with because you have different needs. Not just that you understand the need, but that you actually then meet the need. It's no good just to understand the need. You got to take the next step and meet the need. And then attraction compatibility is that sense of I'm just attracted to be with you, which I think grows in the covenant of relationship over time. And today I want to share with you five B's, five ways to be in the relationship in terms of getting to know each other better. We move from that place of attraction to say, how do we start to move in a deeper understanding of who this person is? When you're in, or if you're not in relationship, I want to say that these five B's are important for you to put in your head now because someday you will be in relationship. So you may say, I'm tuning out. I don't have a relationship in my life right now in this way. But pay attention. Someday you will. Use this as a frame of reference. And if you're in a relationship, dating or married, I think these five B's are part of what God calls us to be about in the relationship. The first one is about the best practice of being friends. That is, I'm going to put in the attraction window, that usually there's a level to the friendship that attracts us to want to move closer into this relationship. Three times in the passage of the love song we look at today, and nine times in the total love song, there is this word, this Hebrew word that I was not before mentioned familiar with, called reya. Reya. It's a powerful little word. I spent much of my study this week on it, because when we read the poem in English, you don't get the weight of what this is. It's hard to translate from Hebrew into English poetry and get the substance of the weight of the meaning. And so it's translated in our NIV, the one that you have in your program, as darling. Well, generally, I don't like that English word darling so much. It just feels, it feels a little soft. It doesn't feel like it's substantive to say just darling. It's a nice word, but that's what it is, a nice word, at my perspective in the English language. But in the Hebrew, oh, the weight of it is just beautiful and significant, but I think it gets lost in translation a little bit. In fact, if we take a look at where it's found in the three verses, he says in verse 9, which by the way, reya, the word, comes from the lips of the lover, the man, and it's always used in the context of an explicit statement about her beauty. Verse 9, I liken you, my darling, my love, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariot horses. Or verse 15, how beautiful you are, my darling, my love, my friend, how beautiful. Chapter 2, verse 2. Like a lily among thorns is my darling among the young women. See, darling doesn't work for me, especially in light of what I've learned about this word. The concept of reya is friendship love with an expressed concern for the protection of her well-being. That we as men take that protective element into this friendship. So reya means to guard or to protect or to tend to, with an emphasis in the context of delight and pleasure, a sense of responsibility. Oh, my darling, my love, my friend, and the depth of friendship is the foundation to it. I think there's some real common sense to it. What makes a friendship work? When you think about your very closest friends, what makes that friendship work? Usually, there's an intentionality of time. You want to be in that person's space, and you create the space for that to happen. And then there's the conversations that happen, the sharing of each other's lives personally and vulnerably. There's availability. The people in your closest sphere of friendship are the kinds of friends that can call you anytime, 24/7. Is that correct? You would receive a phone call from one of those closest friends at 3 in the morning. You just make your life available, right? Isn't that right? I needed something because I'm going, that's how I see friends. They can call me anytime, those closest of friends. And we see that laughter and care is part of it. You remember the section that precedes this that we just studied last week coming into this piece of poetry we just read now, is when the woman is saying to him, where are you going to be? And when are you going to be there? And he says to her, I'm going to be here, and this is when I'm going to be there. They're being intentional to say, I want to be in your space. They want to be in each other's space together. They get creative because there's people all around them, and they find that time to be together for meaningful time together. Friendship is a foundation to their relationship. I find this interesting because I think about the girls that I've dated in my own life. And, you know, I usually asked a girl out because there was an element of infatuation, intrigue. And I'm interested, when I had that experience, typically those relationships would last for 2 months or 3 months, and then they'd fizzle out. And then I meet Carrie, and Carrie and I really became friends. We were platonic friends for a solid year. And then after about a year, I'm going, well, why not? And so I asked, would she be willing to go out? And she had to think that through. Do I want to risk my friendship to go out with you in a different kind of way? And I said, well, why not? And she was receptive to it. And so we built our love on the foundation of a good friendship. And having read this understanding of Freya love, I think there's a wisdom in this. I think there's an implication, maybe a couple of them. For instance, sometimes we expect fireworks to be the thing that lights our soul before we say, that's the potential person I want to be with. But fireworks always go out. They fizzle away. It's not the best way to make a decision to enter into a relationship with someone. And so I want to say, don't rule out a friend as a potential mate. There may be a friend in your life that really is the kind of friendship that could serve as a foundation for romance to be built upon. I think there's another implication to Rhea here, and that is sometimes when you move forward with that relationship and you get married, you put the marriage at risk by allowing others to become Rhea, having that friendship love rather than the mate that you're with. It's an interesting thing to see when we're dating how we create space to be together, and the girl gets interested in football for the first time, and the guy gets interested in art history for the first time, because you just want to grow an understanding of each other, and your intentions are so good, and then you get married, and all of that relaxes. And then you look for the needs of Rhea friendship with friendships outside of the covenant, and it puts at risk the very covenant itself. John Gottman, PhD author and relationship researcher, says, the determining factor and whether wives feel satisfied with sex, romance, and passion in their marriages is by 70% the quality of the couple's friendship. And for men, determining factor is by 70% the quality of the couple's friendship. We're not from different planets. Friendship is a need for the male and the female. And many people think that the secret to reconnecting with their partner is a candlelit dinner or a vacation by the sea. And it's not. It's the little things we do every day that shore up that foundation of friendship for which romance can find life. The call is be friends. Not just at the beginning when it's easy to do it, but in every season of the relationship to follow. Second is to be tender. I'm going to put this one in the communication window because I want you to listen to how tenderly they speak to each other. He first in verse 9, I liken you, my darling, to a mare among Pharaoh's horses. See how sweetly he compliments her by calling her a horse? What a cool guy. I mean, and we might think to ourselves, well, I don't know that I'd really do that. I mean, it's Valentine's week this week, guys. Did you know that? It's Valentine's Day coming up this week. Get a card. I don't know that I would recommend writing. When I think of you, I think of you. You're like a horse. I don't think I'd say that in the card. Personally, but there's a context in which this was very good. The Bible tells us that Pharaoh had 12,000 Egyptian horses and 1,400 chariots. And these horses, the Egyptian horses, were considered the best of the best. And to be selected as the carrier of a chariot especially were the most amazing fleet of valuable prized possessions. These were royal steeds that were the best of the best. And so you got all these thousands of the best kinds of steeds around when this mare, this girl horse, shows up. And what does that do to all of those steeds? You get the context. It creates an excitement. And he's saying, oh, when you come around, I am so excited. I'm so interested in you. And boy, the result of that, she feels desirable. She feels wanted. When you feel wanted in a relationship, oh, everything about the relationship is good. It's when you don't feel wanted, oh, you just struggle with doubt and joy, etc. And some of you guys may say, well, you know, you're not in the relationship I'm in, and I'm not with somebody who's desirable. Or the girl may say, I'm not with somebody who's desirable. And I think there's a wisdom to act the way you want to become. In other words, love her, encourage her, nurture her, bless her, speak tenderly to her, or vice versa, him to her, and desirability goes up. Connect your want to your will to. Act the way you want to become. Last week I gave you a Super Bowl challenge. Do you remember this? We took the, if you were here, I took a couple of the lines from the poem when he says, your love is more desirable than wine and your name is like perfume poured out. And I suggested that at your Super Bowl parties, that in front of everybody, that you would have the courage to stand before your friends and lift a glass and toast your friends and speak about how great they are. And then pause at the end of that toast and you look right into the eyes of your loved one and you say, you are like, your name is like perfume poured out, just to have fun with that. See what would happen? Last night at the service, I asked, how many of you did that? One person raised their hand. Come on, guys, work with me on this. And have fun. I got an email, though, from somebody who did it as well. It was quite hilarious. This is what he says to me. He sent the email. I have not talked with him personally, but he gave me permission to share it. He said, I did the toast last night. After the kickoff, with four couples sitting around the TV, I raised my glass of wine and said, here's to great friends. And then I turned to my wife and said, and here's to my wife who is more wonderful than a fine wine. And there was silence in the room. He said, the toast had two consequences, one unintended. The first is that my wife was thrilled and she snuggled up with me during the whole Super Bowl game. Oh, well, good. And then the second unintended consequence, he said, was one of the other wives looked at her husband and gave him an elbow. How come you never are romantic like that? And the other girls looked at their husbands and said, yeah, you too. And then he went into other details around the evening, which TMI, too much information I'm not sharing with you. I'm not sure I even wanted to know. But he ended, it was such a great night. Out of a context of friendship and tenderness. And listen to her words in the poem, her tender words, which all relate to three different perfumes. She returns the compliments with the best of the best, as he has complimented her with the best of the best. So you find this first reference to a perfume in verse 12. While the king was at his table, my perfume spread its fragrance. The word for perfume here is nard. It's a special nard, a pure nard from the Himalayan mountains of India. Satish Shivana. Do you have this fragrance? No. It's too bad because my research tells me it's an erotic fragrance. You should pick some up and find delight in it. It's of high value, this perfume is. And then verse 13, my beloved is to me a sachet of myrrh resting between my breasts. Oh, myrrh was again a perfume, a holy oil that was used as the at the tabernacle. But it was also one of the gifts that was given to baby Jesus. And what was brought to him was gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Oh, the value of the perfume was significant. It was royal-like. And verse 14, my beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms from the vineyards of En-Gedi. Henna blossoms are just little red flowers with just a pop of aroma that are spectacular. In the midst of a garden, it was the center and the delight to what that garden was about. And this is just no ordinary garden. This is the En-Gedi. This is a real place. It's about halfway down the western shore of the Dead Sea. I was there in the latter part of the 1970s where I studied for a month in Jerusalem, in the old city of Jerusalem. It was a great experience, and we would go out on tours throughout the course of our experience there. And one day we were traveling and seeing sights in the desert when all of a sudden we come to the En-Gedi. In the midst of mile after mile after mile of hot, barren desert, we come to this garden. It is gorgeous, the En-Gedi it's called, with tropical trees and plants, with waterfalls and wildlife right in the middle of this desert. And it was no mirage. It is a traveler's paradise. Thousands of people visit this place every week because it is such a delight to go to it. It's also the En-Gedi where David, remember when he was being pursued by Saul and Saul was trying to take the life of David? He went to hide in the En-Gedi, into the caves of the En-Gedi. To find what? Rest and refreshment. And so in the poem, it's a picture of life, her view of him as being an En-Gedi and creating that place for him. In a traditional sense where a male was the predominant one bringing home the bacon and the wife was the predominant one taking for the home, it had the implication of making your home an En-Gedi a wonderful place for him to be when he's been working and his life has been like a desert, for him to come home to an oasis in the midst of the desert, to be refreshed and to find rest. And so when he would come home and he would lay down on the couch and eat, as you guys often do when you come home, you lay down and you eat. nachos and chicken wings or whatever it might be. That would be my choice. I say to ladies, let him do it. It's biblical. Just don't put a remote in his hand. That's not biblical. And the whole evening can be totally wasted. We're talking a little bit. Rest and refreshment, recalibrate, take a half an hour. Lay down, eat something. It's cool. There's nothing wrong with that. In today's culture, when you have women and men working together, I think it's a mutual blessing that you create for each other in your home and in Getty. That your home becomes an oasis for rest and refreshment. That when you greet each other at the door after a long day in the desert, that you speak tenderly, sweetly to each other. Rather than a honey-do list or railing on each other for all the things that aren't happening when they should be happening. Just take a moment to treasure what you are in relationship in the En Gedi and speak sweetly and tenderly to each other. Something happened in my study this week that I got an aha. After 30 years of marriage to Carrie, whenever we've gone on a vacation, Carrie insists that the house has to be cleaned immaculately. Clean sheets, everything put away. Everything's just top drawer clean. And it's been a huge irritant for me through the years. Because there's always such a small margin when you're leaving on a trip to get everything together. You're trying to get everything done at work. You're trying to get stuff ready to pack and to go. And she wants to clean the house, not just a little dusting. She wants to clean the house, whole house. And now I get it. Because when she wants to come home, when she enters the door after vacation, she wants to enter the En Gedi. After a vacation, she doesn't want to come home and clean the house. She wants to enjoy her home. For it to be clean, a place of rest and refreshment at the end of vacation. So we have a vacation this summer, and I'm not going to complain. I'll do my part with joy this year. After 30 years, I'm glad to learn there's a biblical foundation for this. The concept here is good for us, this issue of speaking tenderly. When you speak, let tenderness be on display. Kindness come from your mouth. Compliments toward each other to be shared. Raising of voices increases tension and conflict. Now, you're going to have times of conflict. In a few weeks, we'll spend quite a bit of time on that. But sometimes we let the conflict be the domain rather than parsing out adequate time to be tender with each other. And when we're tender, we create a space, an En Gedi. How do you do with that? Is your home an En Gedi? And then the third B is to be a builder. I put this in the character window. I do this because the eyes are to the windows of the soul where character is forged and found. And listen to this, verse 15. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes are doves. How handsome you are, my beloved. Oh, how charming. Speaking this way to each other does something. It builds esteem. When you enter into relationship at the front end, you're always building each other up. You get married, you get casual, you lose the intentionality. You start to tear each other down rather than to build each other up. But God's vision for a relationship that's meaningful and sustainable is that there's the building up of esteem. That doves represent peace and tranquility and purity and faithfulness. Your eyes are like doves. He's saying, when I look at you, I see peace and purity. I see love. And I see all the things that attract me to you. And she might be a little bit sheepish, guys, when you look her in the eyes this way, versus a fleeting little glance, if any glance at all. But when you hold her eyes and say, man, I enjoy you so much. I appreciate you so much. She likes that. Guys, you get that? She likes that. We get uncomfortable around this arena, but it's so important for us to be able to connect with the eyes of another person and to be able to share these things, to look at them and express appreciation, because the result is she feels honored and secure and significant. And then you won't have to find it from your kids first or your friends first or from your colleagues first, because you're going to find it from him first. And so she gets her esteem, her emotional well-being from him. So to you who are using social networking, especially you teenagers and young adults, and maybe you're at the front end of trying to find somebody to be with, and a lot of your connection and learning of each other comes through technology. Okay, that's good. That's part of our culture today. But if it's at the expense of being able to look into each other's eyes, to be able to see the soul, because the eyes are the windows to the soul of a person, then you will miss the depth of what God intends for you to have in relationship. And it's really not all that difficult, is it, to be able to look into a person's eyes and to express tender words, to compliment. Do that eye check. I encourage you to do that. I do this with Carrie all the time. We just had fun with it through the years because we know when we're not looking at each other's eyes, there's either too much going on in our lives or there's something between us, but we don't want to talk about it. And a day can go by or 2 days can go by. So we started to notice this pattern in our journey. You could go for a week without looking into each other's eyes. That's a good sign that things aren't where they need to be. So we've made a practice to be able to stop. Okay, look at me in the eyes when you say that. And we'll take a moment. We'll just look. And you can tell. We need to talk about something, don't we? And sometimes I'll just grab her cheeks and say, oh, I love you so much. She says, take your hands off of me. No, she doesn't. But, you know, eyes really do. They're that reconnecting place. Your eyes will reconnect you more than words ever will. So don't lose the beauty of eye check. It helps build esteem in the journey. And then the fourth is to be safe. From verses 1 through 5, just look at how she responds. This is amazing how she responds when he's all tender with her with this. She says, I am the rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. And he says, like a lily among thorns is my darling, oh, my love, my friend, among the young women. And she responds, like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my beloved among young men. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. Let him lead me to the banquet hall. Let his banner over me be love. Oh, so beautifully stated. Let who you are and what you say create a safe place. I put the safe place under character as well, because I think the quality of your character is what creates the sense of security and safety in your home. And this is what is being said here. She's saying, you are like an apple tree in a forest. Well, how many of you have done a hike in a forest and have ever seen an apple tree? Nobody. Apple trees aren't in the forest. And so it's poetry. It's giving a picture. You're unique. You're different. You're like an apple tree in the middle of a forest. All these ordinary trees, and there's this apple tree that does what? It provides shade. It's a picture for us of protection. She finds shade under that apple tree. Does your loved one find shade under your apple tree? And she finds fruit, which is a picture of satisfaction. Does she find fruit in you? Nourishment and love that builds trust. Here's the deal, guys. Look after her, tend to her, protect her, nurture her, make sure she's okay. And when you begin to date someone and you start doing this, it starts to build a foundation of trust, where she'll be more free and open. And if you're married and you do this, it builds a foundation of security and confidence, of safety. See, personally, I don't want my wife to go to anyone else to find that shade or that fruit or that banner. This is what God gives to me. This is what I'm supposed to do. This is what I want to do, is to provide that for her. So I'm not going to raise my voice with Carrie, because I want her to find shade from this apple tree. And if I'm always raising my voice at her and yelling at her, she's not going to find shade under this apple tree. She's going to look somewhere else for that shade. I don't want her to look for another man to find the affection that she longs for in her soul. I want my fruit to be sweet to her. I'm going to say the sweet things. I'm going to speak kindness to her. I'm going to touch her tenderly, because I want her to find her shade and her fruit from me. I want her to know that she can come and sit under the shade of this tree any day and every day. And it's a safe place for her to be. Guys, create an environment of safety and protection and care so you can hear her say, oh, how you love me and how you protect me and how you stand with me. Might you hear her say that his banner over me is love. Banner is it's a military term. It's a flag. It's advocacy. That is, she has the trust and the confidence that wherever he goes, he advocates for her, not tearing her down, building her up. That's the picture of safety. I had a guy last night after the service come down, mid-30s probably, and he said, boy, did I need to be here tonight. He said, I have not been a good apple tree. I am broken. He said, I need to be a better apple tree. I needed to be here to understand shade and fruit need to come from me. That's the gift that we get here. And then we have this turn, kind of a cool turn. It's a bit of a funny verse, and I'm going to wrap up with this piece of it. Verse 5, it says, strengthen me with raisins, refresh me with apples, For I am faint with love. His left arm is under my head and his right arm embraces me. The full Hebrew phrase here that isn't translated in our version is raisin cakes. She says, strengthen me with raisin cakes. And if you were a Jew, you laughed out loud because you understand the implications of that. That the raisins in the raisin cakes have seeds which serve as an aphrodisiac. And she is so turned on by all those tender words, she wants to throw herself at him, not just in an ordinary way, but I want some raisin cakes. I want this to be extraordinary. She wants to just feel the freedom of her love given to him. It's a funny verse. It's an erotic verse. I laughed when I read it. Perhaps you had to be there at that time and place. All because he's tender to her. So ask the question, is this a safe person or an unsafe person? Dr. Henry Cloud and John Townsend wrote this book called Safe People. And on the back of your teaching notes, they have a list of who makes a safe person and an unsafe person. I just put it there. I'm not going to walk through that list. I want to encourage you to get the book if it would be helpful for you. I had a young man last Sunday night after our Element service come down. I mean, he was in his late teens. And he said, I've been in 5 relationships with girls already. 4 of them have cheated on me. At that young age, I said, listen, the problem is not those girls. The problem is you choosing a girl who is unsafe. You need to understand yourself and how to find somebody who's safe in your world. And that's what triggered this. I want you to get that book if that would be a helpful tool for you. You can see I have one more there to be self-controlled. I'll pick that up next week. It's a very important one. I don't have time to do justice to it here. But before we go, I want to pray for you. I want you to have a lot of fun with this series. I really do. But I also understand that there's a broken heart in every row. And so I'm praying that God will bring healing and hope in this series. And I also know that some of you don't know God. You've not lived for God. You've not looked for God's wisdom and voice. And you have to know God to have that. So I want to give an opportunity for you to receive Christ into your life. After each of these services, if you've never received Christ, listen to the prompting of the Lord. So would you just pause in a holy moment and let's go before the Lord. Just bow your head for a moment. Pray with me. Father, it seems to me we're entering into some of the most sensitive domain of our lives, relationships, where we have been burned, and we feel vulnerable. Sometimes we felt exuberant and joy-filled, the extremes of emotions that come in relationship connection. And somewhere, Father, along the way, we've lost our compass because we've lost your voice. And even in our churches, we haven't spoken as boldly as your word declares for us to speak about these matters. They're so important. So where there's brokenness, Lord, you know it well. And I just pray by the power of the Spirit that you would do only that which you could do. That where there's despair or discouragement or disillusionment in relationships, that you would bring hope, wisdom, courage, humility, so that your voice would guide the voices of those navigating this difficult terrain. And I'm mindful of those in the room who've not looked to your voice, but have listened to themselves in these decisions and the decisions of their life. And I pray, Father, that you would bring people to salvation in each of these gatherings as we have come together. If you are a person who has not yielded your life to the Lord, if you have not taken the hands of your steering wheel and said, Lord, I want you to be the Lord of my life, I'm willing to slide over to let you lead me. You've not done that before in your life. Would you pray this prayer if you feel the prompting of the Lord to move in that direction? Lord Jesus, I acknowledge that you are the Son of God and the Savior of the world, and that you bring a wisdom to life that I have not sought. I have sought my own. I ask for forgiveness. In this moment, I want to receive you into my heart. Come, Lord Jesus. Guide me. Lead me. Amen. If you prayed that prayer, during these 9 weeks, we'd like to give you a Bible. In the Bible is a yes card to say, yes, I prayed that prayer. Last week, 70 Bibles left this place. God is meeting us here. God is meeting us. So I encourage you yield your life to the Lord. If you prayed that prayer, take a Bible, fill out the yes card, and tell someone that you received Christ into your life today. Because the scriptures say, if you confess Jesus as Lord and believe that God has raised him from the dead, you will be saved. Tell someone. Would you stand? May the grace of God, the love of our Lord Jesus Christ, the presence of the Holy Spirit be with you and yours as you leave this place. Grow in love with him and each other. L.